Be sure to stay tuned on We Act for Mark Levine.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine. I have on the line with me
Terry D. Kester.
And Garland is off celebrating Easter. We don't blame him. Of course, Terry celebrates Easter, too. I celebrate Passover. This is Religious Week here on the Raucous Caucus. And in fact, it's going to give us a chance to talk a little bit about our own personal religious beliefs and encourage you to do so, too, at 202-889-9797. The question, the main question for this hour, though we'll talk about other things. I definitely want to get to the Supreme Court oral arguments on marriage equality. We will go there. But the main question this evening is, how can progressives who believe in, you know, change and new things and equality for all support thousands of year old religions that, let's face it, have not always been the most progressive in the past or even in the present? It's a tough question, but one that Terry and I are going to take on heads on. Right, Terry?
Yeah, amen.
And then you go to church. And then you go to church afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Got a little bit of echo on the line. I don't know if that matters or not.
But. Well, I don't want you to have echo. Let me see what I can do about that. And
because it sounds kind of good.
Well, you know, I don't want you to be all echoey, so I'm going to try to work on that. But I don't hear it in my line, so
good.
At least I don't think it's coming out of the main studio. So if you can handle the echo, tell me about how you're going to go to church after this discussion today.
Well, I will be attending an Episcopalian church. I'm a recent member of Episcopalian churches, and I celebrate Easter, I guess, by just staying in sort of a wondering state. I accept the mystery that's in religion and religious stories. I don't need all of the answers to everything. I used to think I had to define the whole darn thing. I used to think I had to define God and everything else. And when I couldn't do that, then I gave up on God. But I no longer.
But you didn't give up on Easter.
I gave up. Pardon?
You gave up on Easter and church and everything too.
I became your typical atheist trying to be an agnostic.
Okay.
Then an agnostic trying to be an atheist. And finally, I stopped trying to figure out the whole darn thing so that I could be comfortable with it.
And so how are you comfortable with it? I mean, listen, there are lots of people who are progressives who say, now, wait a minute. You know, if you're Christian, you got a whole bunch of people in robes, you know, men in robes dressing up with red heels who are apparently anti-gay and definitely don't allow women to be priests, don't allow gay people to marry. That's sort of the Catholic Church. The Orthodox Jewish religion certainly has men and women separated, isn't so pro-gay rights either. And certainly when it comes to evangelical Protestants, they're probably the worst in terms of being anti-progressive in all manner of things. So how do you sort it out for you? Is your church a pretty liberal church? I suspect so.
Well, let me put it this way. To me, I learned quite a while ago, actually, or believed quite a while ago, that religion is a tool. It is not necessarily an all-answer thing. I think our faith is developed through experience, not to say that religion can play a part in that, but religion is a tool, and because of that, I can misuse that tool and distort it, you know, the same as I can use a hammer to hit you on the head, or I can use the hammer to build something. In a church or a religion is a tool that hopefully I can be part of that builds something good. And so to me, there's not a difference. I mean, and if anything, in Christianity, you know, the basic premise of Christianity is, you know, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might. The second commandment, like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself. So once you begin to accept those two ideas, how can you exclude somebody?
Well, no, that makes sense. I mean, to me, religion is a fascinating mix. Actually, when I think about it historically, I think religion, and I'll talk about my own, Judaism, is one of the great progressive things. You know, look at the Exodus story, which, of course, is what we celebrate in Passover. And not only do we celebrate the story, but we tell the story. You know, I sometimes I think that Easter becomes all about a bunny and eggs rather than the resurrection of Jesus. But, of course, Jesus, who did not, as far as I know, hide eggs on Easter.
No, there were no bunnies. Not that I know of.
But did celebrate Passover.
Yes.
And in fact, the Last Supper is a celebration of Passover, which I might point out, not to pull rank or anything, but the Exodus and the Seder were already about 1,200 to 1,500 years old by the time Jesus celebrated. Jesus celebrated almost like midway through the history of Passover from the beginning till today. So it's already been around for more than 1,000 years. And of course, the Exodus from Egypt celebrates a tiny people's freedom from slavery. And when you think about the world in which we live, to attack slavery 3,500 years ago is amazing. We still had slavery in this country 150 years ago. We had slavery in this country 3,000 years after the Exodus from Egypt. But yet this story, and I think it may be the oldest continuous religious observance on the planet. I don't know of any. There are Chinese and Indian religions older than Judaism, to be sure, and African religions, but I'm not sure of a continuous traditional observance that's older. If there is one, you know, hey, let me know about it, because I don't know about it. 202-889-9797. But certainly one of the oldest on the planet. And when you think about what a progressive idea, that slaves have rights, that slaves deserve not only to have rights, but to be free from the yoke of oppression, and to celebrate a God that freed the Hebrews, for freed the Israelites from their misery, and to tell the story of their misery and of the beating and of the horror with which masters treat their slaves. I know that, for example, for the African-American community right here in the United States, under the yoke of slavery, they took inspiration. They were probably shocked to find this story in their Bible, but there's certainly a number of old spirituals, you know, go down Moses, way down to Egypt land comes to mind. So this has been an inspirational story, not just for the Jewish people, but really for all of humanity.
And that story continues. I mean, you know, last night I was at a pre-Easter service, or I'm not exactly how you label it, but then, and it began with the story of Exodus, you know, which is part of the Christian religion as well. But more importantly, and you know, something happened just in the last few days that sort of continues that story and serves that story, and I pay tribute to the new Pope, Pope Francis, because he did something that's never been done in the Catholic Church before. In Christianity, you know, there is the ritual that Jesus supposedly does to his disciples before he is arrested, and he washes their feet. And that's part of something that slaves always did for upper-class people, because your feet would be very dirty, obviously, in the Middle East, in open shoes, etc. So you'd go into a house, and a slave would wash your feet. Christ changed that entirely by he washing his disciples' feet, and Pope Francis broke all tradition. Instead of washing the feet of cardinals, he went to a prison, a detention center, and washed the feet of young men and women, which has never been done before, in the ages of 15 to 21, prisoners, you know, people in prison, and washed their feet and dried their feet, and even went so far, some people may find it strange, but went so far as to kiss their feet after he washed them. His whole point, and he literally told them, I'm here to demonstrate that I am your servant, which is a whole different concept within the Catholic Church, and I'm sure there are many Catholics and cardinals that are shocked by that, but at the same time, that's exactly what Christ supposedly did 2,000 years ago, the idea being that the servant and the master, the only master is God, and the servant is each of us.
Well, and that's, I guess, what I want to point out, because if you listen to the Fox Newses of the world, and by the way, I'm going to be on Fox News as much as
we'll
I can, damn it, at 1:30 Eastern time today. So in about half an hour after the Raucous Caucus ends, they want me to talk about why they think teachers should be packing heat, why they should be owning guns. Rambo. When I think of my elderly art teacher as Rambo, it's sort of a disconnect in my mind, but so I'm obviously against that. I think teachers should do something really unusual. I think they should teach, which I know is extreme for them. But my point is that when you go to a Fox News, they seem to have this unalterable dialogue that there is a fundamental disconnect, I'd say, between progressive liberal values and religion. And I think there are actually some on the left that would agree. And again, I'm not knocking anyone who's an atheist or an agnostic. You have the right to believe whatever you want to believe. This is a free country. Some of my best friends are atheists. I'm not knocking that. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of progressive values in religion. Now, I'm not saying there's no tension. I'm not saying there's no conservative or regressive values in religion. In fact, over the next hour, I want to tease out what I think are the progressive values in religion, but also be very honest about what I think are the regressive or conservative values in religion. One of the things I like about my own practice is I'm not Orthodox Jewish. I am what you might call Reform or Conservative or Reconstructionist. There's actually all kinds of varieties. But we firmly believe, ironically, it's called Conservative Judaism. I'm sorry, not a conservative. But we firmly believe that you can take the historical tradition, keep and celebrate the things that continue to hold true, to hold value today. To me, the Passover Seder is a beautiful ceremony because it's really as much about freeing human beings from slavery as it is about celebration of God. Yes, we celebrate God's role in the freedom, but at the same time, we tell the story, and we definitely talk about people all over the world, not just 3,000 years ago in Egypt. These progressive values are not unalterably opposed. And I guess I'll give you one more from my tradition that I'm very proud of. I don't know where older than the Bible is there the story of a king that has higher law. If you go to Egypt, if you look at ancient Egypt, where the Israelites were enslaved, the Pharaoh was king. I mean, mm-hmm. And again, this is an idea that continues way up till, you know, the 1800s, where the French king said that he was a god. There are certainly rulers today. Kim Jong-il comes to mind. Kim Jong-un,
yes.
The next one, who certainly sort of proclaims himself sort of godlike. But this idea that the ruler is God is not a new idea. It's a very ancient idea. It's probably one of the oldest ideas out there. But when the Jewish people, when the Israelites are having trouble fighting against the Philistines, they need to bond together in a group, and they need to have a king because they want someone who's strong. They get their first king, and the king basically says, you know, I can do whatever I want. I'm king. And the prophets, the ancient prophets, if you read the book of Isaiah or even Judges, look at 1 Samuel, the prophets go to the king and say, no, you're not in charge, not the Jewish king. You are second in command, as it were. God is in charge. You have to follow God's laws. So when a certain king, I believe he was Uriah. I'm trying to remember which king it was, but I know that he wants to take Naboth's vineyard because he likes the vineyard. It makes really good wine. He wants it. And most kings just want a vineyard. They take it. And the prophet says to him, you can't do that. Sorry, you have to follow God's law. You know, King David, the greatest Jewish king, wants Bathsheba because she's really beautiful. So he sends her husband to the front in the wars and grabs her. And the prophet says, hey, that's not okay. That's not cool. And the king says, hey, I'm king. And they say, no, you're not. For us, God is king. And one of the powerful things about religion, people don't think of it this way, is it actually means that human institutions are not as powerful as they could otherwise be. If there is a higher law than the king, then suddenly you really can't have a justified dictatorship. It's the beginning of democracy, I would argue, right there in our Bible.
Well, one of the most fascinating things in the Old Testament, and I can't remember the exact sequence, but I think it's with Samuel, but is the whole idea when the Jewish religion or Jewish state, I'm not sure exact status at that point, but, you know, they're about to get a king. And, you know, the prophets and the God literally say, you don't want a king. You really do not want a king. Don't do this, you know, because, I mean, what they're saying is you're going to have a human being who's so darn flawed, you know, that no matter how righteous they may or may not be, that you're going to leave yourself open to all kinds of problems. And, you know, then finally, you know, the agreement is, well, okay, if you're going to have a king, if you have to have it, then choose this person. And immediately, of course, there are problems in having a king. But the original instruction is, what you want to have is a unified spiritual community that doesn't need a king. I think one of the ironies in our current politics is we, in our terms of our expectations, we put some of our political leaders on that pedestal and expect them to be able to change the whole darn universe. and fix everything, and that's not possible. It takes so much more than that.
I want to also talk about other progressive values that I think are in religion. And again, I don't mean to gloss all this over. We'll get to some regressive values in religion a little bit later on the program, because I want to go there too, particularly when we're talking about things like marriage equality that came before the Supreme Court this week. But another progressive value in religion, I think, is concern for the poor.
Yes.
You know, prior to Judaism, Christianity, you don't see a lot of concern for the poor. Certainly, you know, I've been focused on ancient Egypt because that's what we talk about in Passover. But, you know, the Pharaoh did not have much concern for the poor. You know, he worked his slaves to death. He got his pyramids out of it, which still stand today. But that's a testament, as far as I'm concerned, to, you know, the slaves and how hard they worked, and maybe to the engineers. That's not the Pharaoh. I mean, he just gets a fancy burial place. But then when you look at Judaism, you look at the prophets, they're always talking about the widow, the orphan. People aren't aware, I think, of some of the really progressive things in Genesis. And let me give you an example that I think that if preachers talked about it more, it would be shocking. So here you have in America today, people complaining that Barack Obama is a socialist, which, of course, he's not even close. And you have tends to be in America, people who go to churches, religious people tend to be more Republican, more conservative, more against progressive values. And I would say, you know, to a fundamentalist preacher, do you know about the Jubilee year? And if you don't know about the Jubilee year, I'm going to ask you to take out your Bible and turn to Genesis. I actually don't know the chapter, but I'm sure you can find it if you Google it. But in Genesis, it sets out the laws for redistribution of wealth. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
What it does is I know, Terry, you knew. I want to make sure our listeners knew. You set out your field, and every year you give a corner of your field for the poor and those that don't have land to reap and take whatever food they can so they can eat. Once every 7 years, you leave the whole land fallow, which again allows the poor to reap what they can. It also, by the way, allows the land to rest. And then after 7 times 7 years, after 49 years, the 50th year is called the Jubilee year. And the Jubilee year, something extraordinary happens. This is once every 2 generations or so. The generations were short around then. On the Jubilee year, every 50 years, all of the land in ancient Israel is redistributed so that every single family gets an equal share. So God orders his law. Right? All the people that are like, well, you know, being gay is against God's law, or any thing, or let's face it, eating pork is against God's law. Well, you know what's also against God's law? Hoarding wealth. Because God orders that all the land in the land of Israel be redistributed among every family every 50 years. You know, Barack Obama is nowhere near the kind of socialist God is. God is a radical socialist redistributor of wealth. And I would say to Joe the Plumber, you know, I don't know how much you hate Obama, because he's if anything, a tiny minor socialist, but you must really, really hate God, because God is the most radical socialist you've ever heard of. Now, I know of lots of preachers that fulminate against one verse in Leviticus that says, man shall not lie with a man. I should note that it says nothing about women, so lesbians, you're okay. You're fine. But they talk a lot about that one verse, but there's chapters about the Jubilee year that I don't think are mentioned much by these preachers. And then fast forward, of course, to today, to the new pope, who I'm liking more and more, I got to say. Pope Francis is appealing to me precisely because he is following this tradition of caring for the poor. And again, if you think that religion is all about conservative values, check out their concern for poverty. It couldn't be more against the power structure that is.
And, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because even in the Episcopalian Church, and most Episcopalians don't pay attention to it, the primary mission of the Episcopalian or Episcopal Church in the United States anyway, which is slightly different from the Anglican Church in England, but the primary mission is to eliminate poverty.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mission. Now, they have other missions, and everybody likes to concentrate on the other missions, but that's the key mission of the Episcopal Church.
Eliminate or diminish. I mean, Jesus said the poor shall always be with us. So I don't know that
diminish is what happens realistically.
Right.
But again, the point being that your focus needs to be, you know, not accumulating wealth, not accumulating power, not accumulating, and this is the main fault that in conservative Christians or conservative religions, you're not trying to create comfort for yourself. you are trying to give to others so that they may progress to the point of being able to give to others. And, you know you're never going to eliminate poverty entirely, but if you don't work at it, then your religion is kind of hollow.
Well, and that's the point. I think there's a lot of progressive teaching in religion. And one of the clearest examples I can think of, we can go back to, the very first story of Genesis, come back to Adam and Eve. Again, Adam and Eve is often used as a way to, original sin, or as a way to come up against gay people. The way I see it, Eve came from Adam's ribs, so there's a little bit of, self. Anyway, I'm not going to go too far with that analogy. But the point about Adam and Eve that I think is so important is this idea that we're all descended from one person. Now, I believe in evolution. I don't believe there was a single ape that is, or monkey that, chimpanzee that is the ancestor of all mankind. It's possible. I don't think they've proven that. But the idea that we all came from one human being is vital, because how can you have racism? How can you say that some human beings are better than other human beings, or that some race is better than another race? To me, the idea that we're all from one group of parents suggests to me that, yes, all men and women are created equal because we're brothers. And this, again, this is a biblical idea. This is a religious idea. It's not one that you have to necessarily accept. I mean, I can think of certain cultures that have caste systems where you actually talk about some human beings as better than other human beings. And certainly we have a long history of racism in this country. But again, religion can provide the progressive answer, which is that we're all in this world together. We're all brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and the other thing that I've discovered over the years, and particularly of some recent reading I've been doing, is because theological things, spiritual things, are very hard often to describe in worldly terms, stories are created. And I'm not arguing whether the stories are true or not. But, I mean, one of the significant things about, of course, Christ is he constantly used parables.
Right.
And he used parables because he knew what he was trying to accomplish and trying to explain is extremely difficult for humans to basically embrace. So you use stories. Whether Adam and Eve is a true story or not is irrelevant.
Exactly.
The point is that we are, made in God's image. The point is that we come united. The point is that we are all brothers and sisters. And that's what we need to study rather than argue about whether Adam and Eve got thrown out of the Garden of Eden 6,000 years ago. I mean, that's not the point.
Yeah, people really don't understand the point when they're saying, well, I don't believe in evolution because it says that, God created the sun and God created the moon and all of that. To tell a story, you say on the first day he created this, on the second day he created that. That doesn't mean it didn't occur over eons. It wouldn't be a good story to say over 3 billion years, the star, no, that's not how you tell a story. You begin once upon a time, and no one says, well, what time? Which time? Was it upon it? Once? What happened before that time? No, that's not the point. Once upon a time is how you begin a story. And I think that the stories of the Bible, whether the Old Testament or the New Testament or Jesus' parables, that telling a story often illustrates a larger truth. That when you tell a story, Aesop's fables, it doesn't mean that we actually had talking grasshoppers. but the point of that story that, you should save for a rainy day or whatever, or Joseph's dream, actually, which is also about saving and making sure that, you have the resources for when you need them. All these stories are all about their theme, all about their moral. They are not about whether we literally had a talking grasshopper. That's not the point. And people who say the earth is 6,000 years old are completely missing the point of Genesis. Frankly, they're missing the point of the Bible, because the Bible was not meant to be taken literally, particularly when it gets to its story aspect.
Right. And just imagine, if we accepted one story, and that being the story of Abraham. Just imagine if in the Middle East, the leaders of Syria and Lebanon and Israel and the Americans and the Europeans all sat down, and the beginning of their conversation is, we are all from the seed of Abraham.
Isaac and Ishmael are brothers.
We are brothers.
That's exactly the point. And that's, so here's what I want to do. I want to take a quick break, Terry. When we come back, I want to talk about sort of we've talked about all these progressive values in the Bible, But that's not how most, I'd say, Americans think about the Bible today. When people think about the Bible, they think about it in extremely conservative, in regressive, in repressive ways. And I want to talk about how that happened and how we can reclaim religious traditions for progressive values. And also want to encourage people to call in at 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine and Terry DeKester. Garland is off celebrating Easter. He'll be back next week. This is the Raucous Caucus, and we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with
Terry DeKester.
And we are the Raucous Caucus. We're missing Garland today, but he'll be back next week. He is off celebrating Easter with his family. And Terry, what are you going to do to celebrate Easter when we're done talking today?
Well, you know, actually, I mean, in a Christian tradition, which I have to admit, you know, I'm fairly new to, but the celebration is really, you know, a 3 or 4 day thing. And it begins, of course, when, you know,
Good
Christ...
Friday.
Yeah, well, even before that, when Christ arrives in Jerusalem, you know, and...
What's that day called?
Well, it's prior to the Passover.
Palm Sunday, right? Is that it?
Palm Sunday, yes.
So apparently I know more about Christianity than you do. Okay, just so we're clear here.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
All right.
Yeah, on Palm Sunday. You know, so that's when the Easter... And even before that, of course, there's Lent, which is supposed to be a time of reflection and repentance.
Right.
But, you know, it begins with Palm Sunday. It begins with the triumphant entry of Jesus into
Jerusalem.
And... You know, then it progresses from there to, you know, Jesus simply telling his disciples, this is how it's going to work out, and you're not going to like it. You know, it's going to be pretty ugly and pretty mean, and of course they don't want to believe that. And then it's on Good Friday that Christ is arrested, then tried on trumped-up charges. Mm-hmm. How common is that in our world?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
he probably didn't have the Gideon versus Wainwright access to counsel.
No, I don't think they did. And they had, of course, you know, all of the leaders of the elite of that time, you know, condemning him. And then even the people condemning him, following the lead of their toxic leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crucifixion. You know, so, and then in that crucifixion, you know, one of the things that's really interesting in the Episcopal Church, and I think some other churches do it, is, you know, on Maundy Thursday, which precedes it, they strip the altar, and basically they tear apart the Christian church. They strip the altar, all the candles are eliminated, all the decorations are eliminated, the cross is sort of covered, you know, and it's a dark, desolate, frightening time. There is no Christian church for those couple of days.
Well, I guess according to Christian religion, correct me if I'm wrong, but Jesus really does die on that Friday. He's resurrected on Sunday, but you know, that Friday and then I guess Saturday, there's no God, there's no Jesus at least around.
Only in retrospect could you say it. In the actuality of the time, no. I mean, the disciples are in hiding. They're all fled. They're all scared. Peter has denied them. They're acting just like human beings. You know, they don't understand. They're scared. They hide, you know, avoid prosecution themselves, deny Christ, et cetera, et cetera.
Terry,
and then,
yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
You know, and then there is, you know, the resurrection. And again, if you try to explain the resurrection of Christ to a large degree, again, you're missing the point. It's not about some magic that happened. It's about the idea that there is more to life than our temporal existence. And that's the concept, and that's what we should be, at least in my opinion, I don't tend to be a scholar, you know, that's what we're celebrating, that what we see so often as the end of life, or sometimes even the ugliness or tragic end of life, is not the end story. And I would add, Mark, if you forgive me for a second,
go ahead.
Where I have really... really begun to understood this is as a volunteer chaplain. And in the most poignant example I can illustrate, and very early, is working as a volunteer chaplain, and I'm not ordained, I'm just a volunteer layperson. I was called in to deal with and bless a dead stillborn baby. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do this. I mean, I was scared to death, frankly. And I went into this room, this hospital room, with this young, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful mother. And her husband had just arrived, and he was just sort of lost in pain. And she is holding this dead baby. And by this time, the baby had, you know, was basically blue and black, and, you know, from lack of circulation.
Sure.
And she asked me, you know, they wanted me to anoint and bless the dead baby. And I've never done anything like that before in my life, but you don't say, oh, I don't know how to do that, or I don't want to do that. You
right.
just do
you
what
just
they
do
ask.
Mm-hmm.
And if they asked me to wash their feet, I would wash their feet. You know, but so I went ahead and did it in through prayer and, you know, spoken prayer, not having any idea what I should say. And Mark, what I discovered in that, even though I knew I couldn't say it to the parent at this time, I discovered that her, and this is so hard to explain, but I discovered that her motherness had not been diminished at all. And I discovered that the child that was now dead, its life had not been diminished at all. And more importantly, that I just knew that everything continues and that everything is connected and every human being is connected to every other human being, and things are not just about this temporal moment we're caught in. And it obviously was a life-changing experience, that there's more to this life than today, and there's more to life than my death, and even to the point of saying, life is not about, no matter what happens to me, life is not about my suffering, and it's not about my death. There's so much more to it.
Terry, it's very interesting to hear you, because again, religion is so often seen as an oppressive force, and it is. I'm not knocking, please understand. I mean, when you talk about the Taliban, mm-hmm. you talk about Iran, talk about evangelical churches in this country that put out their gay kids and they suffer, and you know, the treatment of women is far from equal in any of the strict Orthodox world religions. So there's a tension there. And I guess my question for you is, first of all, how were you raised in terms of Christianity? And tell me a little bit about this journey away and then back again.
Well, to begin with, I finally figured out that every one of us, each one of us, is on a spiritual journey, whether we recognize it or not. And I sure as heck did not recognize it. I began as a young kid growing up in a rather poor family, actually, quite poor, because I was, you know, right at the end of the Depression. My parents were right at the end of the Depression. I'm that old. And
you that old?
I am that old. I am that old. I didn't get to vote for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but I knew he was around, you know. And my parents took me to church, you know, the Methodist church first, and then later on Presbyterian church. Strangely enough, I was not baptized as a baby. My older brother was. My younger brother was. My parents just skipped over me entirely. They figured, what's the point, I guess.
And look what happened to you, Terry.
Yeah, look what happened. But, you know, so I was struck very early. At a very early age, I understood that something was wrong here in our religion, because the message that I was being given about the teachings of Christ seemed so simple. And I noticed that as a country and as a world, not as a country, but as a people, we weren't really following that message, mm-hmm. you know, loving thy neighbor. Then I went through the usual growing up, and I actually chose to be baptized at the age of 16. And then I went and asked the pastor some questions he couldn't answer, so I quit the church immediately after being baptized at the age
answer?
Of 16.
What were those questions he couldn't answer? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, what I was asking him, you know, was to define God, you mm-hmm. know, in my youth. And, of course, he admitted, being a very honest man, I can't define God, Terry. You know, you must discover for yourself. You know, well, that wasn't the answer I wanted. You know, so being immature and all that, I left. And then, to be perfectly honest, you know, starting with, and I mentioned this on my show on What's at Stake, which was my last show on What's at Stake by my choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sort of violating a principle here by saying it, but I say it in this context. You know,
okay.
I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Right.
And I went on a destructive path that I certainly am not going to talk about over the air, but I destroyed everything I possibly could. And everything in my path and my wake. And at the age of 38, I believe, something like that, 34 years ago, believe it or not, I stumbled into AA, desperate, and I began to realize that I needed help, and I needed help from others, and I needed help from a higher power because I could not deal with the chaos that I had put myself into. The disease of alcoholism. I could not escape it. And slowly but surely, over the next umpteen years, through experience and study, but experience more than anything else, my spiritual journey now is the most important part of my life. And I don't know where it's going, and I don't need to know where it's going. I only know that I am on a spiritual path. And it's a complete change of where I was. I was a derelict drunk. You know,
and I have to say, I've been to one AA meeting. I have a friend who's he's been about 25 years sober. Mm. He still goes occasionally to meetings, and he invited me to come, and I was glad they welcomed me as you know. But I do know people that have gone to AA, have gone to NA, and they swear by them as you know. There's no magic. There's no you know. I don't give you a drug to counteract the drug.
No.
The magic is merely in the community.
Yep.
And also in the surrender to a higher power,
yep.
Basically allowing yourself to admit your faults and at the same time struggle again to find your soul and to find your purpose. And
yeah.
I have a lot of respect for all of these, and obviously it helped you as well. And I'm
honored
that you share this on the air. Terry, I should say, had shared with me some of this story. Years ago, when we met, I never shared it on the air because it's not my story to tell. But I'm glad that you've shown the bravery to do that.
And I do that. I should, you know, that it is against the principles of AA to, you know, we are to remain anonymous at the level of press, radio, television, et cetera. And so I violated that principle.
Well, and you're not outing anyone else.
Yourself. And I'm not claiming myself as any kind of example. I'm just talking about my experience.
Right. Right. Well, I just want to say that what I know of it is also very good. And if you are in need, if you are addicted to something, and it's not just Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a Narcotics Anonymous, there's
yep.
a Sex Addicts Anonymous, there's all kinds of addictions, the Codependents Anonymous, there's all kinds of addictions. And I just want to give – the nice thing about it is, you know, this isn't corporate sponsored. This isn't some program that's making money off you. This is just a bunch of people
right.
coming together. And it's really old-fashioned in that way. And I just want to put in a plug for it myself. And what I've seen, I've only heard good things. In my own religious experience, I've grown up Jewish. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. A lot of people don't think there can be Southern Jews, but actually there are half a million or so of us in the United States. It's very different from the New York Jewish experience or L.A., where you grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. I grew up in a very, very non-Jewish atmosphere. And in that experience, you kind of know from the time you're a kid that you're a minority. I don't remember this, but my mom tells me that I would sit on Santa's lap and tell him all about the miracle of Hanukkah, which made him a little confused. But he was a good sport about it, apparently. But
that sounds like so much like you, Mark.
Doesn't it though? Doesn't it
I
though?
Love that.
You know, so but I had to defend from the time I was five. I was asked questions, why don't you celebrate Christmas? Why don't you believe Jesus is God? And I had to have the answers. And it actually, in terms of someone who likes intellectual and theological questions, you know, the fact that I had to defend my religious beliefs at age five or six, which, again, I don't think it's necessarily so much the Jewish experience, but it's definitely the Southern Jewish experience. It's the experience mm-hmm. of Jews who live in a very, you know, non-Jewish culture. And I also learned just all the things that I really love about my religious teaching. I talked about the Passover Seder, which I should say that I've led in my family. When my grandfather died, he led it for many years, and then my parents tried for a couple years, and then I tried at age, 22 or so, and apparently they liked it because I've been doing it ever since.
That's neat. I've had the privilege of being to a number of Seders.
And you're welcome to come to mine, Terry. Nashville, Thank Tennessee, you. Every Passover, you are absolutely welcome at our dinner table, and my mom
Thank
makes
you.
A heck of a good matzo ball soup.
So I
you're,
bet.
You're welcome to join us. But there are many things about my religious tradition that I really find meaningful. And, you know, for some, religion is all about God. In fact, some would define religion as being all about God. To me, while it certainly is about God, that's, at least for my tradition, my practice, that's almost the smaller part of it, honestly. I'm not knocking God, trust me. I don't want lightning to strike at the React Radio Studios. But I say that in jest, of course. But I, at the same time, to me, these principles, let me give you just one beautiful tradition that I find extremely meaningful. You talked about the death of a stillborn child. I really like, and this is a weird thing to say I like, but I like the way the Jewish tradition deals with death. It's very comforting to me. If you don't know the tradition, what they do when someone dies, first of all, the body is respected. The soul may be gone, but the body is respected. It's washed. It's actually, people stay up all night. There's a group called Chevra Kadisha, Holy Friends, and these people agree to do this task. They stay up all night. They don't fall asleep. Usually with candles, and the body is there, and they treat the body very carefully. They wash it, but no one goes to sleep until the body is put into the earth. That usually it's just a day, because Jews believe in a very quick burial. Sometimes it's going to be 2 or 3 days if you need family to come in from out of town. But there's just this respect shown that no one sleeps while a corpse while a dead body is not yet buried. Then when there is the burial, one of the traditions that I find really meaningful, even though it's incredibly painful, really meaningful, is the idea that everyone buries the dead. It's not like you let the body in there and, you know, the grave diggers, they bury it. The tradition is for all of us, old and young, to grab a shovel. An 8-year-old or to extend a 92-year-old can grab just a little like spade or whatever and put a little bit of dirt on the grave. We all bury the dead together. It's not seen as some task for some menial labor, but it's actually considered, according to Jewish tradition, one of the highest mitzvot, one of the highest good deeds, to bury the dead. And the reason is because any other thing you do for human beings, you could do it for purely kind reasons, or when you help someone, a lot of times they help you back. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of the way the society we live in. You do some good for someone, they do good for you back. That makes for a wonderful world. So I'm not knocking that. But the reason why this is the highest of good deeds, the highest of mitzvot, is because you're doing a favor for someone who cannot help you back.
Yes.
It's a pure good deed. There's absolutely no expectation of anything in return. And there's something incredibly painful and yet weirdly wonderful for me about hearing, about digging in, you know, you're in your suit, right? And you dig into this dirty, you grab a big shovel and you dig into the dirt and you hear the harsh sounds of dirt hitting the top of the coffin. And that's very painful. It really leads to a lot of crying. But there's a certain, I don't know, finality. There's a certain feeling that you're doing the last thing you can do for this person that you loved. And then even going on, I like the tradition of the Shiva, which is 7 days. The tradition is that for 7 days after someone dies, you focus on them. You take off from work. You focus on the death. And 7 days to me is, again, it's tradition, but to me it's the perfect amount of time. 1 day is not enough to focus on someone's death. Someone you love that's very close to you, 1 day is not enough. You can't expect it to bury them 1 day and go back to work the day after. On the other hand, more than 7 days, and you can dwell on it. And I think if you sit and alone and you focus only on someone's death for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 days, that's harmful to the living. So they set a day. They say 7 days. And during those 7 days, again, I don't know if you know the tradition, Terry, but you are in your own house. You don't leave your house. And people bring food to you. You don't cook. You don't clean. Your guests do the cooking. They do the cleaning. They cover the mirrors because you're not supposed to worry about what you look like. And they come and they sit with you and they pray with you. And there's another little tradition that I really like. In the first 3 days of the Shiva, of the 7-day period, People come in, and you're only allowed to talk all 7 days about the person who died. You don't talk about the weather. You don't talk about sports. You don't talk about, you know, Aunt Ida's new shoes. You talk only about the person who died, but it doesn't have to be sad. You could talk very happy stories. Usually they're actually, shivas can be quite fun as you tell funny stories about the person who died. But what's interesting is that for the first 3 days, you don't talk at all unless the mourner speaks to you. If the mourner wants to talk, everybody talks about the person who died. If the mourner does not want to talk, you stay silent out of respect for the mourner. In the last 4 days, interestingly enough, then you are allowed to sort of prod the mourner, if they haven't talked for 3 days, to talk about the person who died. And these traditions are thousands of years old, and there's just, to me, there's this beauty about protecting the mourner, protecting the memory of the dead, and but also bringing them back to life. So after 7 days, the strict mourning stay-at-home process stops, but there's 30 days where you don't go to weddings, you don't go to movies, you don't do really fun things. That's shloshim, which means 30. And then you still say a prayer every day for the year after passing, and then on the anniversary of the death, so as that you always remember, you say a special prayer. And to me, this whole idea of bringing the mourning to respect the dead completely, but also bring them back into the living, it's a beautiful tradition. You could argue that it's not about God, really. It's about humanity, and it's one of the traditions I really like of my people.
You know what that reminds me of, Mark, and I really appreciate your just describing all of that, because in a sense, what you're talking about is community and relationships. And there's a fascinating book, which many people have probably heard of. It's actually the number one New York Times bestseller, which I just came upon recently. It's been around for about 10 years or so, maybe longer. It's a book called The Shack, and I recommend it to everybody. And you may not accept the story, and I had some problems with the story and the writing, but the messages in it are incredible, and they are profound. And the point, or one of the points, let me put it that way, of all religion and of our relationship with God is to have relationships, meaningful relationships with each other, that life is about building relationships with each other and with the higher power, whom I choose to call God, and solidifying that relationship and appreciating that relationship. And if we all concentrated sort of in that simple idea of valuing each other, of respecting each other, of respecting each other's traditions, of building relationships with each other, it would be a different world. And what you've just described is beautiful, because it's about people caring about people.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, I think, what people sometimes don't understand, that that is what religion is about. It's not only about a one-on-one relationship with God, but it's absolutely about community, loving thy neighbor as thyself. And to me, that's what makes the parts of religion that are reactionary, and they still exist. Certainly, women are not equal in any of the the most religious of the traditions. One of the reasons I'm not an Orthodox Jew is because I don't like that they separate men and women. I don't think that's fair. Women can't be rabbis. I should say, though, that proudly, that 90% of American Jews are not Orthodox, which means that we have women rabbis. They marry gay couples in 90% of Jewish synagogues across the country. That's pretty good. We haven't gotten the Orthodox there yet, but it's better than most churches. And there is a proud progressive tradition among Jews, and particularly among American Jews, but also among Jews worldwide, that recognizes that if there was the understanding of gay people today, back then, that there wouldn't be oppression anymore. I'll give you one more example from my tradition, and then I got to go, Terry, because I'm going to be on Fox News at 1:30 saying that teachers shouldn't be armed. So I think that's important, and I'm encourage everyone to watch that. Just so you know what I'm going to do when I'm done with Terry, we're going to start the Inside Scoop. I'm going to play for you an hour from a show I did in the past on how children are being abused in some residential treatment centers. I'm doing that because there's a convention coming up this week in Washington, the Survivors of Institutional Abuse, that, by the way, others are welcome to check out and attend. You don't have to be a survivor to support this idea. It's SIA convention. Just Google SIA convention 2013. You'll find out all about that. But I wanted to play this about what went on at Diamond Ranch Academy, because I want people to know about that. I'm going to play that while I go away for an hour, go to Fox News, and then come back at 2 for more live Inside Scoop, where I'm going to talk more about the Supreme Court hearings on same-sex marriage, and also and talk about what happened in Steubenville and what we can do to teach teens, speaking of teens, to respect their fellow man. Let me end with one thing, and then Terry, you've got the rest of the floor till 1 o'clock. In terms of the gay tradition. One of the things when I'm arguing with Christians about gay rights, I simply say, hey, you still eat pork? That's not in the Bible, you know, so you're breaking the Bible. So, you know, and if they say, well, Jesus says you don't have to do that anymore, I say, well, then you don't have to do the anti-gay stuff either. It's actually an easier argument with Christians. With Orthodox Jews, the argument is harder for me because they don't eat pork. They do follow every law of the Bible. But here's what I tell to Orthodox Jews when they argue against gay rights. And again, it's a minority. It's only 10% of American Jews, and even many Orthodox Jews are very progressive when it comes to gay rights. But when I come to those that aren't, here's what I remind them of. In the Jewish tradition, prior to the 1700s, people who were deaf did not have rights in the community. They were considered deaf and dumb, and people didn't understand that. They couldn't hear, but they still were every bit as intelligent and normal as you and me. They just couldn't hear. People said dumb for a reason. Deaf and dumb, they actually thought they were dumb. They thought they were stupid. And they didn't have rights to vote, the democratic rights in the Jewish community, until the 1700s, when scientists determined that, guess what? Deaf people are just as smart as anybody else. They just can't hear. They're not dumb. Mm-hmm. They're just mute. At that time, even the strictest Orthodox Jews gave deaf people full Jewish rights 300 years ago. And I would argue that just as science proved that deaf people are perfectly normal, except that they can't hear, gay people are perfectly normal, except they have a different sexual orientation, and that ancient tradition says that therefore gay people should have all equal rights in the Jewish community. So I'm working hard for my people on that. With that, Terry, I'm going to leave you to Raucous Caucus alone for a good 7 minutes while I run over to Fox News and tell them what's what. So thank you for sharing with me, and you can end however you wish. It's your show. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Thank you so much, and thank you so much for all that you've shared with us this morning. Even though I've known you for a number of years, I am really grateful for all that you shared today. Maybe some of the most meaningful information I've been able to receive from you, and I appreciate that. And I think it's pretty obvious to the listeners that Mark and I, and I think Garland too, feel pretty much the same in all of this. Because our spirituality, our faith, is combined with or led with the idea of community and of helping each other and of serving each other. And I don't mean to say that as if we have any superior truth or that we're any better than anybody else, you know, but at least we try. Each of us tries, I know, and even some of in our politics where we get pretty wound up. We're trying to work towards that world, that community, that cares about each other, that, you know, and again, I mentioned this book, The Shack, and I want to recommend it again. You know, one of the things that it points out, too, is in seeking our independence and in seeking our individualism and our exceptionalism, what we're doing in so many ways is creating barriers that put me in a position where I can look down on you because I have so-and-so or I do so-and-so or I've achieved so-and-so. And this individualism, this independence that we so worship, frankly, in the United States and many places else in the world, only creates obstacles and pain. It's not what my God, the God I understand, wants us to do. What he wants us to do is to care for each other and to serve each other. And exactly as Pope Francis did in washing the feet, that is so significant for the Catholic Church. And I think people don't even the more I think about it, the more significant I find that it is. What he did is he took a ritual outside of the Vatican. He took the ritual that is a very important spiritual ritual outside and away from the elite, the power structure within the Vatican. And I'm not saying that they're bad or anything else. I'm just saying he took it there away from them and took it to the people. And who did he take it to? The lowest of the low. Those people who we, for good reasons or bad, have imprisoned. And the message of Christ, too. You know, Mark was talking about the community and about the acceptance finally of deaf people when they finally figured out that deaf people, you know, were not good or bad or not, it's not because of sin or it's not because they're less than us. Every story in the Christian Bible, every story in the New Testament with Christ is about Christ dealing with people, helping people that society rejected. that is so fundamental a part of the Christian story and the story of Christ. These are the lepers, people who were diseased, people who they thought, in their words, were, you know, possessed by demons. What, matter what their affliction, other tribes, other racial groups, the whole message and progress and march that Christ does through the New Testament is going to the people who are despised, the people who are hated, the people who are pushed aside and ignored and abused, going to those people and equalizing them in the eyes of God, of bringing them up and saying, this person is no different or more valuable than I am. That's an astonishing, revolutionary thought and pattern. And it's still something, that's where we, if we're going to be practicing Christians or try to be Christians, that's what we have to progress, and that's what we have to serve. I'm running out of time. There's so much I'd like to talk about, and I really appreciate Mark giving me this opportunity and for Mark and I to be able to talk openly about our progressive religion and being part of a religious faith and at the same time being very progressive in politics, because it's the exact same thing. We're trying to find ways to serve each other. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but I just want to quote St. Francis's prayer. And this is, again, you know, we now have a Pope Francis, and this is a prayer attributed to St. Francis long ago, and I think it puts things in perspective in a very clear way. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O divine master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. That is the prayer written by St. Francis long, long ago, and it's a prayer that we could each use as part of our religion today, no matter what your religion is, no matter what your view of life is. It's a prayer, it's a concept that is worthy of your study, and my appreciation. And finally, I would just close with great gratitude for WEAC Radio, great gratitude to Mark and to Garland, and for continuing the Raucous Caucus, and we will not stop. We will keep on fighting because we care about you, and we care about our society, and we care about our country. And I say all these things with great gratitude. I wish you all a happy Easter, a fulfilling Passover. And if you are not involved in a faith, allow yourself to continue your spiritual journey and let it lead you. It is so beautiful, and you will love it as you discover it. Thank you so much, WEACT Radio. This is Terry Kester. Goodbye.